I'm not going to tell you what to think, not to believe. He put his hand inside his coverall and pulled a small book from within. It seemed to be the same as the one Wrench was holding. Zenobi glanced back to see that the other Beta Platoon troopers were watching her and Natto, glancing up from their discussion frequently.
I don't know what you think I'm here.
This book doesn't claim to have the answers, continued Natto, oblivious to her suspicion. It does ask some interesting questions. It's called the Lectitio Divinitatis.
The Lectio what?
Said Zenobi. Lectitio Divinitatis. That means Book of the Powers. Something like that, in the language of the palace. There's a whole sphere of understanding that's being kept from us. The Emperor, Horus. It's all part of a universe that was hidden away.
He held out the booklet, but Zenobi folded her arms, determined not to be dragged into the man's lunacy.
What sort of thing do you mean?
She found herself asking. Almost immediately she regretted opening her mouth, but Natto gave her no time to revoke her interest.
The warp. It's not just another part of our universe that lets ships travel fast.
His hand still held out the book, and he thumbed open some pages, trying to show her the lines of small print within.
And the Emperor. The Emperor isn't a man, Zenobi.
I don't need to hear this, she snapped.
She advanced, but there wasn't room to push past. For a moment they both teetered around each other, almost falling from the roof, but he spun away with an easy movement, letting her regain her balance. Natto said something else, but she was deaf to his words. The other two stood up, but didn't try to stop her passing. With an effort to still her trembling hands, Zenobi swung down onto the ladder and descended to the carriage at a slide. She barreled through the door and almost straight into someone on the other side. She saw the flash of crimson and looked up into the unforgiving features of an integrity officer. His name was Abioye, assigned to Gamma Platoon.
Is something amiss, Trooper Adedeji?
She backed away, heart thumping. He stepped after, eyes intent on her face, trying to read her like a book.
You seem out of sorts.
Zenobi steadied herself, feeling squeezed between the integrity officer and the end bulkhead of the carriage. It was difficult to see past him, to the press of soldiery that filled the rest of the compartment where her platoon companions and friends were. There was nobody to help her. She swallowed hard, but her fear subsided, replaced by a sudden anger. She hadn't done anything wrong. Why was she feeling so guilty? The lie of omission. That's what it was called, when you knew something but didn't tell someone.
On the roof,
she said, flicking her eyes towards the ceiling.
Beta Platoon. They had a book they wanted to show me.
It took a moment for Abioye to understand her meaning. When he did, there was just a flicker of recognition in his eyes.
I see.
He stepped back, allowing her past.
Return to your platoon. Tell nobody of this.
Yes, sir,
she snapped, her hand rising in automatic salute. She stumbled past into the main part of the carriage. There was more of a semblance of order than when she'd awoken. Sergeants were gathering their squads, and proper billeting arrangements were being made with weapons and kit bags. Zenobi glanced back and saw that Abioye was gone. She felt pleased at her honesty, and not just because it assuaged the guilt by association that had tarnished her conscience the moment she had seen the prohibited book. As company standard-bearer, she had to hold herself to the highest standards of loyalty. And yes, integrity. Rejoining her squad, she was soon swept into the daily life of the Defence Corps trooper, coming to terms with the same routine but in different circumstances. About half an hour later, they were called to attend to the captain, who had reappeared in the carriage from whatever quarters had been secured away from the bulk of the company. She stepped up onto a bench near the door so that she could be seen by the whole compartment. Several hundred pairs of eyes all turned towards her as one.
The transfer station, where we boarded, has been destroyed,
she told them. Each word enunciated carefully, her expression a study in somber impassivity.
There were no survivors.
Zenobi took this news with a sigh of resignation, and there was no particular reaction from the rest of the company.
The trains we boarded are following different lines to the battlefront. It is unlikely that we will see the others again. Certainly not this side of victory for us. Elements of the 64th, 65th, and 70th Defense Corps have come together on this train. Nearly 6,000 troopers and 300 officers and other ranks. Colonel Tedessa is not among them. The Corps are combining higher officer staff functions, and we will come together as a single operating unit. Old squad, platoon, and company designations will remain for the sake of simplicity. However, we are no longer the 64th Defense Corps. All troopers, officers, and other ranks aboard this train are now proud soldiers of the Adaba Free Corps.
There were smiles and shouts of approval to greet this news. Zenobi grinned, catching a look from Menba past the bodies of her companions.
The Free Corps!
Someone shouted.
The Free Corps!
Zenobi called back, along with a deafening chorus of other voices. Egwu smiled, nodding her acknowledgement of their enthusiasm.
Yes,
she laughed.
We thought that would be popular.
The shout of Free Corps went up again, and once more, until the captain raised her hands for quiet. The troopers settled as her expression became serious.
The truth is, the hurried transfer has left us in bad shape. We have the same manpower as before, but heavier weaponry and specialist equipment was still being loaded at the time of our quick departure. The same is true of rations, water sanitation packs, ammunition, and other supplies.
The captain paused to allow the importance of this to sink in. Her stare roamed across her command.
In addition, the crew that were trained to operate the defensive systems of this locomotive were mostly on the ground.
Disquieted mutters greeted this news, and Zenobi sagged with the thought of going almost defenseless into the attack on the palace.
A few that were servicing their weapons remained behind. You will each be shown how to man the guns over the next few hours, and defense shifts will be drawn up by your platoon officers.
Once more she waited for this information to seep into the minds of the troopers, hands clasping and relaxing round the baton she held at her waist. Zenobi could only imagine the strain the past 12 hours had placed on her commander and the other officers. She had no illusions that the rest of her life was likely to be brutal and short, but at least she didn't have to weigh up decisions that would alter the life chances of hundreds, perhaps thousands of others.
Alpha Platoon, you will be first to report for gunnery training.
Egwu lifted her baton in dismissal and received the salute of her company in return. A burst of chatter filled the carriage as she stepped down from the bench and disappeared back through the door.
"Was never going to be a long fight anyway,"
said Lieutenant Okoye. Chapter 14. The Shiv Cuts Deeper. Evidence of Demons. Punishment. Lionsgate Spaceport, Tropifex Corps, 20 hours since assault. 120 strong, the Iron Warrior's insertion force pushed up into the Lionsgate spaceport like a splinter, worming its way towards a person's heart. One by one they had gathered, the small force coming together over the course of several hours, while similar formations did likewise in other parts of the port city. Forex had expected more resistance, but having passed through the outer skin of the spaceport, the warriors of the 4th Legion had encountered little in the way of opposition. Most of the defenders were occupied with the tumult of beastmen and rogue troopers rampaging through the lower levels, or defending against the aerial attacks and landings that had begun in the uppermost reaches. As yet it seemed that the Imperial Fists and their allies thought the middle levels of the port unthreatened.
"More specs shows nothing within 700 meters of our position,"
reported Alax, sweeping the scanning device left and right as the company waited at the junction of a dormant travelator and an arterial corridor. The innards of the spaceport betrayed its purpose as a place of labour rather than a domestic hive. While the outer regions had been packed with defended hab-blocks, communal areas and transit plazas, the core of the Lionsgate spaceport was filled with immense machinery for the transportation of materials to and from the landing docks at the summit, and arranged in a spiral down the flanks. They had passed loading bays vast enough for Emperor-class Titans to pass through, accessed by lifters capable of carrying a company of battletechs. Monorail stations abutted these cavernous spaces, their locomotives missing, but their sidings filled with carriages, each 100 meters long and 40 high. With Vox contact too much of a detection risk, the 4th Legion infiltrators were reduced to picking up the energy signatures of power armor, coupled with transponder beacons with a range of only 200 meters, signals too faint for the standard monitoring stations to pick up. The click, click, click of the Auspex on passive scan was audible above the creaking of the port's ancient metal skeleton, the clatter of chains swinging, and the rumble of the ongoing barrages.
"We'll move up," said Forex, pointing his bolter towards the stationary travelator.
They swept suit lamps into the dark tunnel. The light swallowed after 40 meters.
"Nobody to find here."
Captain Garal led the way, a 10-strong squad with him. The others followed 100 meters behind, close enough to give support if needed, far enough to slip away if that proved the most prudent course. Each of the 1,000 space marines had been chosen by the Trident, based on the reports of the field commanders regarding temperament and patience. No glory hound heroes, no warriors that would put personal honor above the mission. An army of pragmatists, Falk had called it. Forex was in command, but his objective was nebulous. Kroger's cunning plan was good enough to get them inside the spaceport, but ran short of details on what to do once they were inside. To follow the Shiv analogy, Forex had promised to find a vital organ to pierce. Lacking any detailed intelligence regarding the interior of the spaceport, their allies in the Alpha Legion had been disappointing on that account, Forex was left with finding a target of opportunity. In lieu of any defined objective, he had chosen a geographic rendezvous, appointing a grid coordinate as the final meeting point for the force. Smaller formations within the army had been given waypoints so that they approached from different routes, their full strength concealed until it had come together. Falk had laughed at the plan, accusing Forex of confusing the 4th Legion with the Raven Guard. The Warsmith's taunts were easy to ignore. He would likely soon be dead, his body, such as it remained, lost in the upper reaches of the spaceport. Forex checked his positional relay via a blinking dot and rangefinder in his visor display. They were 2 kilometers below and 400 meters southeast of the final meeting point. It was too much to expect that all 1,000 warriors assigned to the mission would evade detection, but Forex hoped that he could gather a sizable enough force before the defenders realized what the scattered iron warriors signified. After that, it would simply be a question of holding out for reinforcement. Would the dual attacks above and below reconnect with Forex's force in time? Or would they be crushed by the Sons of Dawn and their allies, trapped in the depths of the spaceport, far from assistance? Palatine Ark Quarantine Zone, Barracks C, 2 days since assault. The quarters of the Imperial Army personnel had become the abode of giants. 3 custodians stood watch at the entrances to the main garrison block, barring all passage within. Those stationed at the section of the quarantine perimeter had been moved to a holding location deeper inside the Imperial Palace, to the relief of many of them. Inside, at the mess hall where the apparition had been witnessed, the only figure that did not look out of place was Malkador, garbed in his robes of office, staff in hand. With him were Constantin Valdor, the commander of the Legio Custodes, and the Primarch of the 7th Legion, Rogel Dorn. They made their surroundings look like some strange undersized play stage for children. Other elements of the palace defences were of a ratio suitable for demigods so that space marines, primarchs, and war engines could pass at will, but these hastily erected barracks were meant for mortal humans alone. Dawn crouched inside the kitchen, rather than stand with his head awkwardly cocked to one side, while Valdor had removed his high-plumed helm before ducking through the doors.
"The Silent Sisterhood have been over every part of the barracks," said Valdor. "There is nothing psychic here."
"Yet 4 dozen men and women saw something in this place," replied Dawn.
He glared at the spot of bare brick where the vision had appeared, thinking back to recent events on the Phalanx. He could barely countenance the threat of demonic attack here. within the perimeter of the palace walls.
"So what?" said Valdor. "Some reported a woman clad in robes of green leaves. Another confessed to seeing fist-sized flies bursting from the wall. Some claim the bricks turned to putrefying flesh. Others a one-eyed monster with broken claws and the stench of feces." "Some kind of hallucinogenic toxin," suggested Dorne. "Possibly."
Valdor looked around the rest of the chamber.
"There is no central environmental system through which it could have been introduced. Something in the food, perhaps.
Why here? Why now?
Montarion's Death Guard have been bombarding this sector for a month without relent, but there is nothing worth attacking here except lunatics and plague victims." "Perhaps this is the point," said Valdor. "Sooner or later, something has reached the quarantine zone that gave rise to this apparition."
Malkador coughed, one hand raised to his mouth.
"The both of you seem intent on dancing around the real subject at hand."
The regent stared at them, eyes regarding each equally for several seconds.
"It was a demon."
"Demon?" Dorne growled. "Impossible."
"Demon. Neverborn. Nosferatus. Diabolarum. Nephila."
Malkador sat on one of the stools beside a preparation worktop.
"Many names, all the same thing. A warp incursion."
"How?"
Valdor stepped towards the bare wall, a hand raised towards it.
"The Emperor's might shields us from attack of that kind."
"We have seen that the telethesic ward is imperfect."
Malkador looked at Rogel Dorne.
"Your tainted brothers setting foot upon Terra being the most troublesome example. We must assume that the bombardment by the Death Guard and this arrival are connected. Perhaps it was unwise to gather all of the plague victims in restricted spaces. Such confinement concentrates their misery. It provides a... But think of it as a power source."
"Power source? A warp ritual, you mean?" said Valdor. "Like the great slaughter that allowed the twisted Primarchs to make planetfall." "That would suggest assistance from within," Dorne said heavily.
He turned his attention to Valdor.
"I have every warrior I can muster stationed on the walls. I cannot spare any for patrols inside the palace as well. I have few enough custodians remaining after our withdrawal from the Webway. However, I agree with you. This is a matter for my people."
"A proportionate response, Lord Valdor," said the regent.
"We should not let ourselves be too drawn on this issue, Malkador," added Dorne. "The Emperor will protect us against any dangerous assault from the Netherworld."
The regent looked away at that moment, hand moving to his mouth as though to hide his reaction.
"What do you know, Malkador? Are you holding back?"
The sigillite scratched the side of his nose, his glance moving from Dorne to Valdor and then back again.
"There was a time before when the telethesic ward was broken."
"When?"
demanded the Imperial Fists Primarch.
"Why was I not told of this?"
"You know of it,"
said Valdor, catching Malkador's meaning.
"When Magnus came before the Emperor, he broke through the psychic wards."
"I see."
Dorne set his gaze on Malkador.
"Do you think this is the work of Magnus?"
"Doubtful."
Malkador rubbed a thumb and finger together as he thought.
"His last, arrival was done by sheer force of will. It would require a similarly unsubtle concentration of effort."
"Yet you look concerned," said Valdor. "Is Magnus orchestrating a more insidious attack?"
"I do not know," confessed Malkador.
"It should be obvious enough," said Dorne. "I know little about the realm of the psychic, but I do understand that a being as potent as the Crimson King would leave traces for one of your ability to detect."
Malkador sighed heavily.
"I do not know where Magnus is. I have felt his brothers, the ones touched by the enemy powers, but of the Lord of the Thousand Suns I sense nothing. He may not be on Terra."
"His legionaries are," said Dorne. "It seems unlikely he would release them to the command of Horus unaccompanied."
"I cannot give you an answer.
Malkador stood, staff thudding on the tiles.
As I said, I do not know where Magnus is.
Dorn took a moment to absorb this, then decided there was nothing to be gained by pressing the sigillite further. If news of Magnus surfaced, Malkador would be certain to share it.
In the absence of any obvious cause, what are we to do?
The Primarch asked his two companions.
I will have a custodian investigate to see if any further action is required.
Constantine Valdor regarded the regent with a faint smile.
Is one custodian proportionate enough?
A perfect amount, Malkador replied. Who do you have in mind?
Karachi Flats, 66 days before assault. There was a bulky analogue chronometer mounted above each door of the carriage, though somewhat predictably their filigree-decorated hands told slightly different times. Zenobi found her attention drawn to them again and again, checking the passage of time. It was something she'd never been able to do before. Personal chronometers were expensive. Only uphivers would have such things. Everyone else was ruled by the shift sirens, their personal observances, and the routine of daily life. Zenobi had always known when it was 10 minutes before the shift change warning siren, because her neighbour, an older lady named Babette, was a habitual singer, and broke into a tune at the same time every day when she was washing her clothes in the tween shift. That she could now break down her day by the minute was incredible, and she found herself timing various activities to see how long they took. 3 minutes to unpack and repack her basic combat kit, 5 minutes for a self-heating ration can to bring itself to full temperature, less than 2 minutes to devour the warm contents afterwards. Several times Sergeant Alexander admonished her for being distracted, but her new fascination meant that she knew it was sometime around 2:30 in the afternoon when the squeal of brakes brought the train to a long, slow halt. The lieutenants and sergeants barked chastisements as the troopers started to move towards the windows to investigate if anything could be seen outside.
"Four brakes!"
came the call from the doorway, as Captain Egwu entered. The squads fell hastily into place by their benches, arms by their sides, eyes fixed on their commander. Egwu entered, flanked by Jawahir and another integrity officer. Two other officers loitered behind her in the door vestibule.
"As of this time, I am assuming command of the Adaba Free Corps,"
Egwu announced.
"My rank will be General Captain, and I will have joint authority with Integrity High Officer Jawa here. It is an honor to have been chosen for this position by my fellow officers."
"The vote was unanimous," Jawa here interrupted with a smile.
"Indeed, an honor,"
continued Egwu. Before she could say anything else, a cheer erupted from the survivors of her company, a roll of congratulations and compliments. Egwu waited patiently for the ovation to subside, her expression oddly grim. When the last voices of celebration died away, she looked across the company, eyes moving from one officer to the next.
"The Corps will assemble to witness punishment," she said gravely. "Alternate squads will ascend to the roof. Others will disembark to view from the ground. Punishment will be enacted in 20 minutes.
This pierced the mood instantly. Egwu and her escort advanced along the carriage, the ranks parting as she approached, until they had moved on to the next compartment. Lieutenant Okoye rounded on his platoon.
"You heard our general captain. First squad to the roof."
The troopers bustled towards the gangway, but were stopped by the lieutenant, who plucked a lasgun from beneath the bench and thrust it into the arms of the closest soldier.
"Armed! We are at war!"
They retrieved their lasguns, checked their power packs, as they had been trained to do, and then followed their sergeants in orderly fashion out of the doors and onto the roof. Now that the train had stopped, the ascent was less precarious. They led Epsilon Platoon up, meeting the first squad of Alpha Platoon halfway along the carriage. Zenobi found herself between Selene and Member. The crackle of the orbital attack to the northeast had not changed one bit in the hours since she had last been up there, and her squad companions marvelled at the display, as she had done.
"It's been going like that for half a day now," said Member. "How long can the palace shields last?"
"I heard the lieutenant say we should be in the Himalaya within 2 days,"
said Ketai from further along the roof.
Do you think they'll last that long? Doesn't matter.
This came from the Alpha Sergeant. Zenobi didn't know his name.
Bombardment might level the palace, but you need soldiers on foot to clear the ruins. The Emperor isn't going to stand on top of the Sanctum Imperialis and let Horus drop bombs and plasma on his head, is he? There will be plenty of fighting before this is over.
You sound eager,
said Member.
In the years from now, when my son and daughters have grown up, I want to look them in the eye and say I fought for them,
the sergeant replied, his eyes drifting to the distant, unseen palace. A half-smile danced on his lips.
I will tell them I was with the Adaba Freekor, and I fought at the Imperial Palace to ensure they would never be the slaves of tyrants.
The Freekor!
Zenobi shouted, swelling with pride, her fist punching the sky. A few others echoed her shout, but Member gave her a quizzical look.
Remember what we were saying earlier? What the lieutenant told us?
He dropped his voice and leaned closer.
Nobody's going to make it back to Adaba. Nobody's telling their kids or grandkids nothing. Maybe not,
conceded Zenobi.
But our names, what we're going to do, will be remembered for a long time. Careful, Ye-Ye,
said Celine.
Glory is an empty plate to feed from. I don't want glory. I want to inspire,
said Zenobi. It was the first time she'd been able to articulate that particular ambition, but the words seemed to capture her feelings well enough.
Maybe someday a child in Adaba will read about Zenobi Adadeji and how she carried the banner of the company at the Imperial Palace. And maybe they'll think that was worth something, and maybe want to do something brave and strong too. I'll be dead, I know that, but at least my life and death would mean something.
Not many heroes on the line, said Ketai.
No. Everyone that works the line is a hero, said Member. You don't have to fight and kill to be a hero. Everyone still back at Adaba, manning the guns, heaving energy packs, pumping the water filters, is a hero.
Said like a true believer, said Ketai. The recruiters really did their work on your family.
Any retort was cut short by activity further down the train. One of the storage wagon doors opened, wheezing down on hydraulics to make a ramp to the grey soil. A procession of integrity officers appeared, several dozen of them. They descended in pairs, each carrying a body. Zenobi sucked in her breath as she saw them, dressed in Freekor coveralls, their collars and fronts stained dark. The bodies were unceremoniously dumped in a pile about 30 meters from the train, and the integrity officers returned, but emerged minutes later with a fresh cargo of the dead. Speculation whispered back and forth along the roofs, and from those squads closer to the action came the rumour that they could see the badges on the bodies. Most seemed to be from Beta Platoon, in Zenobi's company, some from other platoons and two other companies. There had to be more than 400 dead, heaped together in the dust, by the time the integrity officers were finished.
Throat's cut,
came the murmur along the line.
Not wasting ammunition,
followed soon after. Voxmeters crackled into life along the length of the train. The distortion in the voice that followed was so bad it took several seconds for Zenobi to decipher it as belonging to Jawa here.
These are the dishonored dead. They have been found harbouring intent that is against the cause to which we have all pledged ourselves. The rot of false belief had taken root in their hearts and was deep, but fortunately had not yet spread far amongst us. In better times we might forgive such transgressions with milder punishment, but we are at war. Spare no sorrow for these traitors, for they would have doomed us and the cause for which we will fight. It is not for their beliefs that they have been punished, though they are at odds with our ideals. It is the disobedience and clandestine conspiracy that surrounds their actions that has taken them from the path of integrity. By allowing these forbidden ideas to foster, to indulge in the conceit of speculation, they have shown themselves to be untrustworthy in all matters. They have allowed themselves to give ear to false promises, to consider fantasies that would erode their dedication and courage.
A score of integrity officers marched into view, two columns of 10. Between them shambled half a dozen other figures. They were naked, and even at this distance, Zenobi could see that they were bruised and bloody, eyes swollen shut, some limping, others holding broken arms awkwardly.
Their leaders! Had they been ignorant, then punishment for negligence would be due. Worse, they were orchestrators of this dishonesty. Harbour no illusions, warriors of Adaba. The enemy has spies amongst us still. You were warned that elements dangerous to our cause were among you, and yet these criminals not only protected lawbreakers, they encouraged them, sponsored their lies in an effort to further pollute our resolve.
Feedback whined through the speakers. Zenobi winced, teeth gritted against the hideous noise. Jawahir's voice was replaced by a deeper tone. General Captain Egwus.
Friko! Attend for punishment!
She ordered through the crackles of the voxmeters. Zenobi, like the thousands of others lining the roof, came to attention, Lasgun at her side, the banner pole gripped tight in her right hand.
For the willful spreading of enemy propaganda and other actions at odds with the cause of the Adaba Free Corps. These officers before you are condemned to summary execution.
The naked men and women were compliant, spirits broken, as they were forced to their knees next to the mound of those they had led into deceit and death. The integrity officers stepped back and drew their pistols. One of the captives suddenly rose to his feet, fists balled. The report of pistol fire snapped through the air and he fell, half-twisting from bullet impacts. Another volley rang out, felling those on their knees, puffs of blood exploding from their foreheads before they slumped into the dirt.
In 49 hours, we will reach the terminus of our journey,
Jawahir announced over the voxmeters.
You must remain vigilant for all deviancy. Failure to disclose transgressions is itself a crime against our integrity.
These last words made Zenobi shudder. Member must have felt her unease, for when they were dismissed, he turned to her.
What's the matter, cousin? They spoke to me,
she said quietly. The words came as a stammer, as the magnitude of what had occurred hit her.
The conspirators tried to recruit me. I could have... What if I hadn't...
She tailed off, gaze dragged back to the corpses left beneath the careless sun. Already a cloud of flies was gathering. There would be maggots and other insects. No cleansing farewell in the end fires. Perhaps the integrity officers had already known about their secret. It seemed unlikely. Zenobi knew in her heart that the pile of dead was a direct consequence of her actions. She had never raised her lasgun, had not pulled her knife. With just a few words, she had killed several hundred people. The thought numbed her.
You didn't, and you wouldn't,
Member said, grasping her arm to pull her along the roof with the rest of the squad.
You would never betray us.
The train jolted into movement, the snarl of immense engines throbbing along its length. It brought Zenobi's thoughts back into focus. Those that had been snared by the lies of the Lectitio Divinitatis had been targeted for a reason. It was a virus, claiming the Emperor was a god. It eroded everything they fought for, and someone had been the first to whisper its untruths in the ears of Beta Platoon. The rot had been introduced, perhaps not even maliciously, but it was not her that had killed those men and women. Someone had corrupted their companions, knowingly risking them for their own ideals. It took just one traitor to taint everything around them. Zenobi steadied herself and looked at the other squad members, eyes resting on her cousin, and then past him, catching a glimpse of Ketai as he swung himself down to the ladder. It wasn't her loyalty that she was worried about. Chapter 15. A Custodian Investigates. Stand by your guns. Barossus. Palatine Ark Quarantine Zone, Barracks C, 2 days since assault. For 3 hours, Amon Toromachian had walked the halls and corridors of the Quarantine Force Barracks to acclimatize himself to its layout and atmosphere. It was cramped for the custodian, who had disrobed of his armor after an hour so that he could inspect some of the smaller spaces. Clad in anti-ballistic tunic and nothing else, he returned once more to the kitchen, where the manifestation had been encountered. He crouched before it, eyes closed, picturing the scene as it had been when the Imperial Army troopers had clustered into the tiled chamber. He had read their accounts and spoken to each of them in person, and could locate almost all of them within a metre or two of where they had likely been standing. He stood, head brushing the ceiling, eyes still closed, using his mind's eye rather than any physical sense. Two forces converging from each set of doors. Afraid, some of them had opened fire. Amon moved to the wall, fingers gently moving across the rough bricks and lines of mortar. The indentations where last strikes had hit, some from the left, most from the right. No grouping that he could discern. He backed away half a step, adding the strike pattern to his mental picture. Why here? He retreated a few more paces and opened his eyes, glaring at the silent brickwork. What was important about the kitchen? The first witness, Trooper Chastain, had confessed to sneaking into the mess facilities to procure an illicit off-shift meal. Cross-interrogation had revealed nothing amiss in his character or record. An opportunistic pilferer, but not an enemy of the Emperor. So why had the apparition appeared in the kitchen? Had Chastain's guilty presence triggered something? Would any of them have been the wiser, had not the hungry trooper entered at that time to encounter the manifestation? He let his mental gaze widen again, encompassing the whole garrison block and the kitchen's place within it. It was a squat, unappealing building, butting against the low quarantine wall around the Palatine Arc, now the Plague Slum, nicknamed Poxville. The kitchen, one of three, was located in the southwest corner, closer to the outer wall than the others. Was that significant? As though controlling a picked drone, he cast his mind back to the corridors, retracing the steps of the troopers as they had come to the kitchen. A short journey, nothing of importance there. That was the moment Amon realized there was a blind spot. He'd paced out every passageway and room. There was a void of about 4 meters square next to the kitchens, right behind the wall. With quick strides, he circumnavigated the mess area and came upon the officers' quarters that were set behind it. A large, tattered banner hung on the far wall of the main hallway, which led to 4 individual officer dorms. The hallway was about 4 meters short. Amon carefully lifted the banner from its hook and set it aside. The wall was plasterboard, painted light grey, like the rest of the barracks. He set his hand to the right side of the centre line and pushed. There was a tiny amount of give, but nothing else happened. Moving to the left-hand side, he did the same. This time there was a faint click, and the wall section spun about on a central spindle, revealing a chamber beyond. His eyes pierced the darkness and took in the surrounds immediately. As soon as he saw what lay beyond the wall, Amon activated his vox.
"Signal Regent Malkador. Tell him that I need him to come to the quarantine barracks immediately."
It was an exceptionally humble shrine. 2 crates had been covered with a rough canvas for an altar cloth. Upon this had been set 2 metal cups, battered from much use. The regimental inscriptions still clear on the sides. Mercio 24th and Gallulus 31st. A ewer of red liquid, cheap wine, Amon's nose told him, sat between them. In front was neatly set a small cushion, upon which had been placed a book. The book was little more than a sheaf of mismatched paper held together with thin wire. 2 words were written on the front, in plain handwriting.
"Lectitio Divinitatus," said Amon.
"A fane of the Emperor," said Malkador,
eyes passing over the rest of the room's contents. Amon's gaze followed his, taking in a few chairs in a circle and some tall candlesticks, likely looted from a senior officer's belongings.
"And this?"
Amon pointed to a stain upon the bare wall, directly behind where the apparition had been witnessed in the kitchen beyond. The rime had almost fully melted, leaving streaks down the brickwork. The floor beneath was also damp, bare ferrocrete darkened by the liquid.
"That..."
Malkador cleared his throat and peered at the phenomenon more closely.
"That is not good news."
Amon sniffed the air, detecting old sweat, gun oil and boot polish, as well as the musky scent of the unlit candles and the sharp ozone-like tang he always associated with the Emperor's regent.
"It's just water ice, nothing else."
"Yes, just ice," said Malkador, scratching his chin. "Created by a massive localized drop in temperature."
But it's between two large ovens on the other side, said Amon. He could picture them precisely, without even recourse to his helm's special suite of visual systems.
Very localized.
Malkador flipped open the small book, eyes scanning the pages.
We have known the cult of the Emperor has been active in the Imperial Army for some time.
This is not a revelation, said Amon. The Laetitia Divinitatis is even more widespread in the civilian population. Efforts to curb its influence were suspended when the siege began.
Yes, resources better spent elsewhere. I recall being at the Senate when such decisions were made.
You disagree?
I'm unsure. The Laetitia Divinitatis could end up being an enormous distraction from the real problem.
But? Malkador gestured towards the ice-soiled wall.
This is residue of psychic activity.
Does not the Emperor's shield suppress such energies?
Hence my concern, said Malkador,
as he met the custodian's gaze.
The Fane and this are connected. But it is not clear how.
What does it mean?
That's a rather complicated question, isn't it, Amon?
Malkador chuckled for a moment, and then grew serious again.
It means a crack. A tiny crack in the telethesic ward, forced from the inside.
There may be other instances that have gone undocumented. Perhaps even taken as signs of the Emperor's divinity. Amon stepped outside the shrine room, his memories of the Webway battles trying to surface at the thought of demonic activity. And the Captain General must be informed.
Valdor has many concerns, as does Lord Dorne. This will be brought to his attention during the hourly briefing as usual. And he will say that you must continue to investigate, because you only have evidence of one minor incident so far. Is this an isolated phenomenon, or cause for wider concern?
This worship of the Emperor is forbidden. Monarchia was destroyed, and a whole legion of space marines chastised for misplaced piety. The Emperor has made his thoughts on the matter very clear.
I was at Monarchia too. I need no reminder of what the Emperor thinks about divinity,
snapped Malkador.
And yet we cannot fight our own people at the same time as we combat Horus. Practicality necessitates some leeway.
Leeway is just a euphemism for a weakness that can be exploited, said Amon.
Our war cares little for absolutes. The matter at hand requires careful examination. You cannot hope to find and prosecute every gathering of the Laetitia Divinitatis. Find out what is particular about this group. Why did the manifestation occur here?
I think it obvious that the proximity to the assault of the Death Guard gives us some answer.
But how widespread is the effect? Not every plague victim is found. Is there some other connection we can chase down?
The cult is secretive. It will take a long time to make progress into its workings. The regent joined him in the hallway, staff tapping on the hard floor as he stepped past. The Lord of Terror stopped a few paces ahead of Amon and turned back to him.
There I may be of further assistance to you, Amon, said Malkador. Someone with an inside knowledge of such things.
Nagapur Territories, 60 days before assault. A series of staccato machine bleeps over the voxmeters roused Zenobi from a half-slumber. She opened her eyes, still slumped against the back of the bench, and looked first towards the windows, still daytime, moving to evening. She sat up as her gaze passed over the others around her. All were looking at the speakers with some confusion, a loud hiss emanating from them. Brakes squealed into life, suddenly slowing the train. As a human wave, those standing tottered and swayed from the sudden loss of momentum, several troopers tripping over each other or benches, their swearing lost amid the laughter of their companions. The lights flickered and went out as the train came to a stop. The yellow light of late afternoon did little to illuminate the interior through the grimy windows. The voxmeters crackled again, and then came the voice of General Captain Egwu.
There is a high risk of detection by orbital scan. All systems are being reduced to standby to dull our energy signature. Remain inside the carriages until further instruction.
A worried silence followed this pronouncement, until Lieutenant Fellamy broke the stillness.
"You can talk," she said with a shake of her head. "They won't be able to hear us in space."
This is all just a precaution, added
Okoye, making his way between the benches.
Command have received word that a starship is passing over this sector. It is unlikely we will attract any attention, not when there are far more important targets to attack.
The mention of targets and attack did nothing to ease Zenobi's concerns. She stood on the bench to look out the window, hoping to see something that might take her mind off the sudden stillness. The ancient dry seabed stretched for kilometers around them, nothing else in sight. It felt a blessing and a curse to be so isolated. It seemed unlikely that they would be discovered amongst the expanse of wilderness, but on the other hand, any energy signature or vox signal detected would stand out like a guide flare at night. A flurry of movement drew her eye to the door at the far end of the cabin. A slash of scarlet announced the presence of an integrity officer. Another was prowling between the benches on the far side of the lattice that divided the length of the cabin.
"Remember, be vigilant at all times,"
he told them as he started a slow patrol of the compartment, his hands clasped behind his back.
"Be aware of your companions. Watch for any oddity in their mood. It takes only a moment for security to lapse, and betrayal would see us destroyed. As you are watchful, know also that you are being watched. Not by your brothers and sisters in arms, but by enemies, masquerading as troopers loyal to Adaba. They will see your laxity and exploit it. They will appeal to your compassion and empathy, and turn those virtues into weaknesses to be exploited. It is not just our guns that will carry us to victory over those that would make slaves of our future generations. It is our resolve that will prove the greatest of weapons. If one of us flinches now, before we have even been tested, what will be their actions under fire?"
The integrity officer stopped about two-thirds of the way along the carriage, almost level with Zenobi. His eyes were a startling blue, unusual amongst the folk of Adaba, and they were like daggers of ice as they passed momentarily over her. She held her nerve, reminding herself that she had no shame to bear, that she feared nothing from the scrutiny of that piercing gaze. The officer moved on.
"Just sitting here, waiting for it to happen."
Zenobi turned her head to find Babak climbing up next to her. He was almost as short, his delicate, callous-free fingers fidgeting with the belt of his coveralls. She knew him as a spindlewright, one of those who maintained the machines that made the parts for the production line.
"I know what you mean," she said. "I think I'm ready for battle. But this isn't that. No chance to fight back. Just waiting for a beam of light to come down and obliterate us."
"Don't be silly,"
said Ketai from across the gap between benches. He looked relaxed, hands behind his head.
"A ship's not going to waste a lance strike on a train. Even if they spot us, it'll just be catalogued among all the other data."
"Starship surveyor expert, are you?" said Babak.
"It's just sense, isn't it?"
Ketai sat forward, hands moving to a pocket from which he produced a slender plastic flask. He pulled the stopper and offered the drink to them. Zenobi caught the smell of spirits. She'd never drunk before and was curious, but now was not the time to give in to that temptation. She shook her head.
"Isn't that contraband?"
said Babak, his gaze flicking nervously around the carriage.
"What if the integrity officers find out?"
"It's like the train and the starship," said Ketai with a shrug. "This isn't important enough to bother them. Maybe Lieutenant Okoye will put me on latrine duties, but nobody is taking me out and putting a lasbot in my head over some tie."
"Throat cut," said Babak. "Like those others. You're not worth the lasbot."
Ketai laughed and stoppered the flask before slipping it away. Zenobi noticed that he hadn't actually taken a drink himself, but said nothing. A sudden blast from the voxmeters made Zenobi jump, almost sending her sprawling from the bench. The engines grumbled into life, and motors whined through the floor as the train started to get underway.
"See? Nothing to—"
started Ketai, but he was cut off by an announcement over the speakers.
"Defense quarters! All active squads to their guns! All inactive squads assume protected positions!"
A siren wail replaced the voice, its urgency setting Zenobi's heart hammering against her ribs.
"So much for not being spotted,"
said Ketai, heaving himself up from the floor. Zenobi's diminutive stature made her an ideal gunner, and she crawled up into the cupola while the others got ready behind her. Squads from the carriage on the opposite end of the gunnery car were coming in and moving to their positions too. She strapped herself into the gunnery chair, a single loop over her waist, and then pulled the lever that elevated her into the armour glass dome at the top of the car. In front of her, on a pintle, was a quad-barreled autocannon. It was far too heavy to aim manually. Instead, her hand came to a control stick between her legs, a firing pin projecting from the top.
"Engage traverse motors," she called back.
She was answered by a whine of power, and the stick juddered in her grip. A few test movements set the autocannons rising and falling and adjusting slightly to the left and right. Her feet found the pedals that rotated the entire gun assembly.
"Engage rotary motors!"
A test of the pedals sent her in a circle, first to the left and then the right. She reached forward and flicked a switch, activating a grainy green screen display just in front of her, the gun imager. There was nothing to see except clouds, almost indiscernible among the flashes of static and the darkening sky.
"Check ammo feeds disengaged. Ammo disengaged,"
came the reply from below, sounding oddly distant within the confines of the cupola. Zenobi depressed the firing stud. The autocannons clicked and clacked against their empty breeches.
"Firing test complete. Engage ammo feeds."
There was a heavy crunch and scrape of metal as the four belt feeds were levered back into place within the turret mechanism. Zenobi's thumb hovered over the firing pin. If she pushed it down, a stream of high-explosive shells would be sent searing into the sky. She had live-fired her lasgun during their scarce training drills, but this was of a totally different magnitude of destruction. Added to that was the knowledge that she would likely be firing in genuine combat. The thought made her legs tremble and her head spin. It was not the idea of her death that set her nerves quivering, but the knowledge that others were relying on her to protect them. If she failed, if she messed up in some way, it wouldn't just be her that died, but Member, Celine, even Ketai. Like a battle tank emerging pristine from the end of the line, Zenobi's experiences all came together in that heartbeat to bring another realization. Everything the integrity officers said about vigilance was just as true and important as her stint as gunner. A single slip could bring calamity. If one enemy spy or sympathizer was allowed to infiltrate the Adaba Free Corps, they could ruin the entire cause. Her legs had stopped shaking. The speaker set into the bulkhead just above her head had quietly hissed into life. She could hear someone moving about in the command chamber set into the heart of the gunnery car, the squeak of a chair, the thud of something being dropped on the floor. A few breaths wheezed mechanically across the internal voxlink.
"This is Lieutenant Okoye, 4th Gunnery Car Command Officer."
Feedback whined. There was a pause, punctuated by a few beeps and a hiss of static, which then faded, leaving the connection clear but for an occasional crackle.
"There are aircraft inbound to our position from orbit. It could be an overflight. They could be heading somewhere else. But we have to assume the worst. All weapons are now live. Anti-aircraft explosive rounds have been loaded."
There was another pause, and a sound that Zenobi didn't identify immediately, but realized after a few seconds was the crinkling of plastransparencies.
"The crew gunners have been spread across the train to provide experienced, accurate fire. Remember what they taught you earlier. Follow the line of your tracer rounds and lead your targets. Between the time something appears on your targeting imager and the time you open fire, a fast-moving craft will have covered 100 meters or more. Weight of fire will keep them off us. Do not conserve ammunition unnecessarily."
Lionsgate Spaceport, Mess Effect's exterior, one day since assault. 70 kilometers above the ground assault, where the atmosphere became space, scores of dropship and attack craft squadrons descended towards the Star Spear. They had been travelling for the better part of 20 hours, drifting tens of thousands of kilometres from ships beyond the range of the greatest defence lasers. As they closed to near orbit, one by one their engines lit, a firmament of plasma jets springing into life against the blackness. Like shooting stars they fell, hundreds of craft, each intent upon a different target, angling towards one of the Star Spear's more than 300 docking spars, platforms and quays. six strike cruisers powered through the void, dashing into the surveyor wake created by the massed gunship assault. Drop cascades opened, disgorging payloads of assault pods, ejected from their bays by rocket boosters in the absence of sufficient gravity. As the laser beams of defense cannons speared out, the emptied starships broke away. The last was not quick enough, its void shields lit by the impact of a volatile blast. Like a pack of hounds, the other defense positions converged their fire on the struggling vessel, swiftly overloading its remaining shields. One final slash of red energy tore through its engines, plasma detonations spilling like blue fire along its length. Aboard one of the larger pods, lit by the brief flash of azure, was Barossus, once favored of the Trident, fallen into disrepute after near death at the hand of his Primarch. The systems of his artificial body flashed with sensor data, highlighting the outcrop of ferrocrete to which he fell, as well as a spike of radiation from the detonating vessel above, the ship he had been aboard only minutes earlier. He cared nothing for the loss of the ship, and was long past any fleeting thoughts of mortality its destruction might have engendered, his thoughts wholly concerned with his immediate future. It was quite rare for an objective to conveniently have 300 square kilometers of dock space for gunships and drop pods to land on. It was not a fact that amused Barossus, as the metal capsule depositing him towards the fourth eastward key spur slammed through the thin atmosphere above the spaceport. It should have been his assault to lead, a glorious campaign for one of the Fourth Legion's most lauded warsmiths. Instead, he was encased in an artificial frame, scorned by the Primarch and almost forgotten by his battle brothers. The body of a demigod, with the authority of an infant. Retrojets fired, slowing the pod's descent almost as harshly as an impact, but cocooned in the sarcophagus of his dreadnought armour, Barossus felt nothing. He was only dimly aware of pneumatically powered legs, his arms replaced with heavy weapons. Not for him the familiar pre-battle rush of hormones, a stacked atomic fuel cell for a heart. Crude kinesthetic feedback gave him a rudimentary awareness of self, but to all purposes he was a mind trapped in a prison of ceramite, titanium and plasteel. It was easy to regard his salvation as a punishment instead. Those that had kept him alive, had wired the broken remnants of his body into this machine, had thought they were preserving his legacy. All they had done was extend the life he would live, knowing the shame of Perturabo's censure. More than the physical agony, the imagined pain of ghost limbs, the mental torment of that failure vexed Barossus. He had been ascending towards his prime as commander, a long service in the Trident assured, and all because he had the misfortune to bear bad news. The drop pod slammed into the ferrocrete apron amid a blast of jets and the scattered shrapnel of frag launchers. Not that there was a living soul on the platform to oppose the landing. The access ramp whined down, and explosive bolts detonated to release the crash clamps that held his armoured form in place. Taking a heavy step, the thud of his footfall lost in the thin air, Barossus advanced onto the metaphorical ground of terror. With ocular contacts and inhuman sensors, he observed his surroundings. 700 iron warriors formed the landing force, tasked with securing the uppermost 10 kilometers of the spaceport. There was barely anything alive, the airless upper levels now a haunt only of those with power armor or vac suits. Pieces of debris from the destroyed starship fell around the star spear. This far up, they had little momentum. 1,000-ton chunks of metal and plascrete that drifted through the midnight blue as serene as snowflakes. Barossus barely spared the descending meteors a thought. Even this mission was punishment, assigned a guard dog's role rather than spearheading the assault. Not this time. He was a warsmith in his soul, even if he was stripped of the prestige.
"My warriors! Hearken to me!"
His bellow leapt across the voxlinks to his battle brothers.
"Are we to stand upon this barren apron while lesser warriors steal our glory? Those with souls forged in battle do not stand sentry. They seek out the enemy and destroy them."
Not caring whether any followed him or not, Barossus turned his massive frame towards the closest rampway, leading into the body of the spaceport. he would reclaim his status as warsmith, or be destroyed in the attempt. Chapter 16. Aerial Attack. Khan's Gambit. On the Trail of the Faithful. Nagapur Territories, 59 days before assault. Zenobi felt the vibration of the turret behind her moving. Looking up through the armor glass dome, she saw the tips of twin lascannon barrels swing overhead towards the front of the train. She depressed the left-hand pedal and swung in the same direction, attuning herself to the speed of the rotation. It seemed painfully slow, and there was a second's delay between her foot pushing at the metal and the motors activating. The stick controller was more responsive, angling the guns towards the sky, but their range was limited to about 10 degrees to either side of the center line of the turret. The voxmeter crackled into life.
"We have a confirmed contact. Aircraft descending from orbit to the northeast." "Which way is that?"
Zenobi then remembered that she needed to push the transmit stud in the control panel in front of her. Her left hand found the switch.
Which way is northeast?"
"Check your bearing sphere,"
came an unfamiliar voice. The accent was from a more southern Afric hive, perhaps the Cape City. After a moment she remembered it was DeVault, the gunner that had run them through the brief training earlier that day.
"It's up and to the right of the transmit switch, like a floating ball behind a plexiglass disc."
Zenobi scanned the cluster of controls, trying to recall the hasty tutorial from DeVault. She found the bearing dial. A grubby white sphere marked with compass points and an elevation level, which showed where the turret was pointing and at what angle to the train. She saw that she was aiming almost due north, and used the right pedal to swing back east a few degrees.
"Thank you,"
she said, remembering to activate the transmit. She peered through the scratched dome, trying to find something against the blue of the sky. There were occasional flashes that might have been the sun reflected off incoming aircraft, or equally it might have been the flashes of the last orbital defence stations being destroyed, or perhaps anti-surface fire from one of the ships in the void.
"Aircraft heading our way. Confirm 3 larger bomber-class signals. No escort detected."
"You okay up there?"
Menba's voice was distorted by the metal tube that linked the main gangway with the turret.
"Don't distract me,"
Zenobi snapped back.
"Just make sure you're ready to change feed lines when the ammo runs out."
"Don't worry, cousin. We're all here on the line with you."
She flexed her fingers on the control stick, her knuckles pale from the intensity of her grip. Her other hand fidgeted with the seam that ran down the left thigh of her coveralls, picking at a loose grey thread. There was no chronometer within the turret. It might have been 2 minutes or 10 since she had first climbed in. She wasn't sure. Panning the gun down, she used the imager to look back along the long line of carriages. Fumes from the engines obscured the already murky view, but she could see there was a slight curve to the train, the track bending them left towards the north. Circling around, she looked ahead again. The mountains were larger than when she had seen them from the roof, the skies above them a constant strobe of emerald light and darkness on the crude screen. The siren blare from the main compartment caused her to jerk against the belt over her lap. Her head banged against the plain metal seat back, bringing her focus sharply back inside the turret.
"Tug is detected at 30 kilometers.
Lieutenant Okoye spoke quickly, the first time she had heard him sound anything but controlled and calm. It was easy to forget that despite being officers, those that commanded the platoon and company were as inexperienced with actual war as the troopers they led. Authority on the line was very different to the prospect of combat. They had been assigned their roles underneath the general staff of the 64th Defence Corps, but that entire officer cadre had been left behind or wiped out. It was inevitable, really, she decided. At some point, the appointed hierarchy was going to have given way to the reality of war. In some ways, it was better that it had already happened, rather than later, when they were embroiled in battle.
"Still on an intercept approach. Targets will be in range in 4 minutes.
Zenobi started to hum one of the work songs to keep her mind settled. She trained the gun imager back towards the northeast, panning left and right a few degrees in the hope that she would see something against the artificial storm that boiled above the distant mountains. Clouds scudded across the view, further obscuring the sky. She thought she saw a brighter flash, but it might have been from the ongoing bombardment of the Imperial Palace beyond the horizon. A second later, warning horns blared again, ringing through the metal bulkhead and up through the accessway. The spark became a distant flare, racing towards the train from beyond the clouds.
Brace for...
Okoye's warning was cut off as a thunderous detonation rocked the train. The scream of tortured metal and ripple of noise from carriage to carriage swept around Zenobi. Engine protests snarled below, wheels screeching along the rails.
Missile hit! Missile hit!
Okoye was breathless on the vox, voice loud in her ear, cutting through the afternoise of the explosion.
More incoming!
A faster, higher-pitched rattle replaced the noise of struggling motors. Two pounding heartbeats passed before Zenobi recognized it as the Gatling turrets firing at the incoming missiles. Small streaks blurred across the gun image of view, lit by the brighter spark of tracer rounds every few seconds. Something larger sped past the jade circle of her world, a split second before another blast rocked the train. Perhaps it was only a glancing hit, or perhaps she had become accustomed to the violence of the first detonation. Whichever it was, the second impact seemed less traumatic.
Zenobi, open fire!
Okoye's yell across the voxmeter dragged her back to the view on the gun imager. To the top right of the screen, three bird-like shapes blurred against the clouds. She nudged the control stick towards them, pressing the firing stud as she did so. The thunder of the quad cannons smashed into her like physical blows, her head crashing against the chair back again as she flinched from their fury. On the imager screen, streaks of darkness whirred uselessly into the sky below the murky dots of her targets. Two flashes, almost simultaneous, announced the firing of more missiles. It took barely three heart-wrenching seconds before they hit. As before, they struck somewhere towards the rear of the train, the dual detonations briefly eclipsing the cacophony of guns that raged around Zenobi. She felt the entire train lurching, the drawn-out shrieks of wheels far longer than before, accompanied by a hideous metallic scraping. Zenobi gritted her teeth, ears ringing, and fired again, using a combination of control column and pedal to guide her long fusillade towards the larger blots on the viewing scope. Other streaks of shells converged from further down the train, along with airburst blossoms from the dedicated flak guns mounted on the locomotive cars. The enemy craft parted, becoming three distinct shapes now. One seemed to come right towards Zenobi, two others headed away to her right. She tried her best to track the strike craft coming in her direction, aiming low in the hope that the diving craft would descend into her line of fire. She could see the distinct silhouette as it dropped below the cloud line, stark against the mountain peaks. Broad, flat-tipped wings carried a fuselage that bulged with gun positions. Bright red bursts stabbed from the battery, scoring hits somewhere just behind Zenobi's position. Perhaps they hit the carriage of Epsilon Company. Her mouth went dry and her gut curdled at the thought. She slammed her foot onto the right-hand pedal, turning the turret hard as the attack craft banked away, coming alongside with its flank guns, roaring shells back at the transport train. She thought her next burst hit, but couldn't be sure. Glitters of shrapnel and torn metal fluttered away from the vortices cut by its wings, and she heard a defiant shout from one of the other gun positions.
"Reloading!"
came the cry from below. She realized she had been holding down the trigger stud for several seconds, ripping through the last of the ammunition feed. She took her thumb away so that she wouldn't jam the mechanism the moment the new belts were fed into the loader. Her ears were accustomed to the din of the guns, and through their roar she heard the howl of plasma engines. The attacking aeroplane banked away, twin plumes of blue pushing it upwards again as it sought altitude, the ire of the train's guns following it back into the cloud.
"Reloaded!"
Member's shout came a heartbeat after the loud crunch of the loader being rammed back into position. Her target was gone, either circling for another attack run or heading back to orbit. Zenobi breathed a sigh and lifted a shaking hand from the control stick. Her relief lasted a few seconds, only until the growl and thunder of the other guns reminded her that there were two other aircraft in the attack. At the same moment she came to this recollection, the gunnery car bucked like a snapping cable. Flame washed over the top of the armor glass dome, carrying with it spinning pieces of jagged metal. The boom of the impact consumed her as the car tipped, hurling her against the strap of the chair. She threw up her hands, but not quickly enough to stop her face smashing into the control console. The world listed crazily, and she tasted blood. The screech of twisting metal, screams of her companions, and flicker of flames faded, replaced with the blackness and silence of unconsciousness. Upper Mesosphere, one day since assault. Boarding torpedoes had never been used outside of a void assault, and Khan was starting to understand why. Even in the thin air of the upper atmosphere, friction was starting to overheat the nose cone. His vision was filled with amber displays from the network-linked system of the torpedo. A slight warping caused the whole 40-meter-long missile to shudder erratically, while heat crept deeper and deeper into the circuitry within the nose. It could set off the impact detonators, tearing away the nose cone and ejecting an intense melter blast designed to cut through the meters-thick hulls of starships 30 kilometers above sea level. The alternative was perhaps even less enticing. The circuits would overload, turning off all the impact systems, so the torpedo would hit the side of the Lionsgate spaceport at 400 kilometers an hour with no retrothrust or breaching detonation.
"I am Khorne's blade," he muttered to himself. "There is no life without death. Kill or be killed. Such is the law of battle."
The readout flashed as they passed the 5-kilometer mark, less than a minute until impact. As with the rest of the strike on the star sphere, Vox's silence was absolute, to give the defenders no warning of what was about to hit them. Other world-eaters were following in gunships, 3,000 of Khorne's chosen. But the point of the spear was Khan, and 500 of his deadliest fighters.
"How thick are the walls?"
The question came from Balkoff, who was strapped into his harness 4 seats down from Khan, one of 30 in the boarding torpedo.
"Will the melter blast cut through?" "Too late to ask now,"
the captain grunted back.
"Should have thought of that earlier."
Laughter greeted the reply.
"My wife will feast on the entrails of Sigismund," growled Caudle Aruka. "If the Blade of Dawn is there, he is mine," snarled Khan.
His fingers flexed around the haft of Gorechild.
"I'll kill any that challenge my claim."
Cowed by his assertion, the rest of the warriors lapsed into silence.
10 seconds,
Khan told them. The restraints pressed tighter, hydraulic rams sliding into position along the sides of the torpedo to absorb some of the impact. Lights blinked amber, and then red. Khan felt sudden deceleration with a surge of relief. 20 meters from impact, the melters fired, turning the nose of the torpedo into a white-hot lance. Armor squealed protests, and the rams split, showering hydraulic fluid as the prow met ferrocrete. Khan's neck twisted hard, and he heard a curse from Galdira, who lost his grip on his chainsword, the weapon clattering past them along the deck. Khan looked at the chains he had used to bind his axe to his vambrace. Yes, he had unfinished business with Sigismund, a lesson to complete. The booming detonation throbbed along the length of the torpedo, even as the remnants of the nose cone petaled outwards into an assault ramp. The restraint exploded upwards, and Khan was out of his seat, plasma pistol in one hand, Gorechild in the other. The torpedo had struck a gunnery position, punching through the outer revetment of an anti-orbital laser. The remains of the crew were smeared amongst the debris, their environment suits turned to black tatters, their gun little more than twists of molten metal splashed against the walls. Plunging through the vapour, sirens wailing around him, Khan headed straight on, hearing the pounding of his hearts and the thuds of his companions' boots on broken ferrocrete. Shapes loomed ahead, helmed and semi-armoured. Gorechild roared, taking the head of the first, sweeping the guts from the second. Khan let his nails take him to the bliss of destruction, knowing there was nothing but enemies in front. Sanctum Imperialis, 3 days since assault. The sky over the Sanctum Imperialis was a sheet of flickering purple and black, and had been for months now. The unnatural twilight had cast its shadow over the Emperor's capital for so long that Amon barely paid it any heed. Now he looked at it with new insight, wondering if the storm above was more than just a physical symptom of the long bombardment. Was it indicative of that other, invisible war? He enjoyed a good vantage point on a walkway that ran alongside an abandoned terrace, overlooking the Via Principe, the main arterial route from the plaza of the Lion's Gate to the immensity of the Sanctum Imperialis itself, a city within a city that housed millions, large enough that in past times it would have been considered greater than most nation-states. Its populace had been purged initially, but as more and more of the outskirts by the ultimate wall were demolished in expectation of a traitor breakthrough, increasing numbers of their displaced inhabitants sought shelter in the sprawling shanties that had grown up among the colonnades and fora of the great and powerful. It was to one of the tent slums that Amon travelled, eyes fixed upon a lone figure in the masses half a kilometre below. Colonel Nek Vyazna, a decorated officer of the Ankhorian Dragoons, itself one of the lauded Old Hundred regiments that had taken part in the unification of Terra. It was her name that the lieutenant in charge of the quarantine garrison had finally confessed as his introduction to the Lectitio Divinitatis. Finding her had been easy enough. She was attached to the Dragoon's 3rd Brigade as a command liaison, a position, Amon had noted, that allowed her to move freely between many different elements of the defence force without hindrance. In all likelihood, she had a more senior patron in the general staff of one of the defence regiments, but for the time being, Amon had focused on her as the most promising lead to follow. He'd spent 2 days trailing her from one Imperial Army garrison to the next, and she had interspersed these duties with visits to several refugee encampments. Amon had decided not to attempt to infiltrate such gatherings,